Welcome to PNP Network.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about the book and about your life. And I know many of the folks out here who are, of course, New England Patriots fans out in the Boston area, where we're celebrating the greatest team that's ever been assembled. You played for a team that was pretty good, too. The Dallas Cowboys were in a few Super Bowls while you were there.
Yes, we were in three Super Bowls, and I think the New England Patriots are really looking very good now. And I think that Belichick has gotten this team concept as best as I've ever seen it, and their success is because of the team working for the team.
Yeah, they don't really have any superstars. I mean, I guess Tom Brady is kind of considered one, but they all get treated pretty much the same.
Yes, that's pretty key in a team. So I think that that Super Bowl that they were introduced as a team sort of began something unique, because so many times in the National Football League, you have so many individuals, the great running back, the great cornerback, the great safety, and it's me, and this team is like the Packers of the 60s, it's a team effort.
How do you compare someone like Belichick with someone like Tom Landry, who you played for?
Well, I mean, I think their styles are similar. They're quiet. They're not loud and braggadocious. They go about their businesses and as coaches, and I think that's a similarity I can draw from them.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about your football career. First of all, where did you come from originally? You know,
I came from Austin, Texas.
So that was a big football area anyway, right?
Yes, and then I ended up in Oklahoma. I finished high school there and played high school football. And then I was a walk-on at Langston University in Langston, Oklahoma. And I played 4 years there, three of which I was a consensus All-America. And in 1975, I was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys.
And history began there. You had an incredible all-pro career with Dallas. But at the same time, when you were doing so well on the field, what was happening off-field for you?
Well, I started a relationship with alcohol and drugs that I really didn't understand or comprehend where those relationships could take me, all, you know, voluntarily, without any forethought. I started to drink alcohol and then recreationally use marijuana and cocaine. And over a five-year period, I became addicted to this relationship.
Now, how is this affecting your on-field performance, or was it at all?
I think it had to have some effect, but it really manifested itself more in my relationship with my girlfriend, with authority, with my responsibilities. It really didn't, I never noticed that I didn't run as fast or hit as hard or jump as high. It probably was happening, but I was just not aware of that. But I am aware of the many mood-altering moments that caused my personal life to be completely dysfunctional.
Now, did the coaches at all, or even the fellow players, detect any changes in you? Did they see that you had a problem? Did anybody say, hey, Tom, you got a problem here, buddy?
No, it was more about, you know, he's just crazy. He's got a big ego. Leave him alone. You know, he's a jerk, you know. And because back in the 70s, alcoholism and drug addiction was still in the closet of most families and companies and marriages. It was a covert, particularly when the behavior began to affect the relationships around an individual with an alcohol problem. It was a covert type of condition. And I don't blame my teammates or Landry or anybody for my problems. It was just not in the public forefront where you confronted or tried to help somebody with an alcohol and drug problem, not to my knowledge.
You've written a number of books, a couple of them. One of them I have in my hand called In Control, The Rebirth of an NFL Legend. And the first one you wrote was kind of, at least I think, a little bit angry. It wasn't as well thought of and really circumspect as the one that you wrote here. Well, obviously this is 20 years later. When you wrote the first one, did you write things that you now regret that you wrote?
Absolutely. I had to go back and make amends to Landry, to Randy White, to Tall Jones. You know, at a little shy of 3 years clean, I started writing this book, and I was still angry, not necessarily knowing what to do with the anger. And I was still angry at me, but I'd lashed out at others, because until you are, you know, get better psychologically, you don't know what to do with that fear, that anger, that rage, that shame. And so I wrote Out of Control in 1987. It was a New York Times bestseller, and I thought about it later. After I won the Texas lottery, I won $28 million lottery. I was 16 years clean, and I go, you know, I've been put back into the spotlight a little bit here, a little 15 minutes of fame again. I'm just going to just chill for a minute. When I reached 20 years sober, November 1983 was my recovery date. When it got to be November 8th, 2003, I said, you know, I really need to go back and share what it's been like for me to not drink and drug for 20 years. And I'm a bit more serene, more circumspect, and not angry. And I've taken responsibility for everything that's happened in my life. And I want to share this with families who are struggling with an alcoholic or an addict in their family. And so this book is a sharing of the process that has enabled Thomas Henderson to be a clean and sober father, grandfather, community activist, different guy. So I think there's going to be a word, a sentence, a paragraph, or even a chapter in this book, In Control, by Thomas Henderson, that is going to help people make good choices about their relationships with alcohol and drugs.
It's interesting that many people, when they think of you, always they think of the Hollywood, the thing, the wild guy, you know, the stuff. That's another guy. He's long gone. 20 years, he's been gone now. But I found the book really interesting. I read it the last few days. And one of the things that, when you started off the book, you wrote that you discovered something that you thought was pretty simple, but it's something that took you many years. And it was, I had everything I wanted, but nothing I needed. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, no man is an island. And, you know, I needed relationships, and I needed good relationships. I just didn't know how to live prior to the tragedy of my alcoholism and drug addiction. So when I said I had everything I wanted, that means I had all the money, property, and prestige. And what I needed was a relationship with God, family values, tell the truth. In order to be a friend, you have to have, in other words, in order to have friends, you have to be a friend. So all these little lessons that escaped me in the first half of my life are the things that I hold dear today.
It's interesting that some of the friends that you had at the time, and in fact, you tell a really emotional and really interesting story about your pal that you called Carrot Top for a while, whose life you saved at one point when he was in rehab and you were in rehab with him. And unfortunately, he died from something that, and you watched this whole thing go down, and I'm sure it must have just reinforced in your mind the choice that you made when you went, when you could have driven to Santa Fe or taken the exit for safety, and you something inside you made you drive the right road in more than just a symbolic interpretation here. And
I think I start that chapter out by saying this story could have turned out quite differently. I had a friend who went through rehab with me, and we had went to Palm Springs for a 12-step weekend, and on the way back I had to go to court the next morning, and I was going to prison. I was going to jail. And as we approached on the highway coming out of Palm Springs back up into Orange County, the left went to Newport Beach, the right went to Santa Ana, and 10 miles from that exit he started working me. He says, hey, why don't we go get some crack? You go into prison tomorrow. I won't tell anybody. You know, you're going to jail. You know, you are going to prison tomorrow.
He actually framed it, though, that he framed it that you were going to go get women, but you knew what he meant.
Well, yes. Yes. I absolutely knew what he meant.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I don't really know how God enabled me to make that right choice, but I went left instead of right and did my time, and I think that was a moment when I thought maybe I had a chance to be sober for a long time. Because if you think about it, if you go into prison in the morning, you might not care what happens next, you know? Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, he went to Santa Ana, as weird as that sounds, and was found in a hotel room with a needle sticking in his arm. And that's been part, he was one of my teachers. I saw alcoholism and drug addiction just right up in my face. I mean, I love this guy, but he taught me more in his own pain than I've learned from anything else in my life.
Mm. And you went to prison for, you really hit rock bottom, and you got sentenced to 4 years or so, and ended up spending 28 months in prison. And
yes.
You mentioned in the book how that was a really an amazing time for you, actually. And that instead of wasting the time in prison and doing what so many other people do in prison, which is do drugs and do illicit things in prison, you actually took it as a time for reflection and study and reading and improving yourself.
It really was amazing that I took that, which seemed like the darkest hours of my life, and turned it into, I read everything I could find. I tore the library up. I read several hundred books and just started to reprogram my mind in literature, dictionaries, and really went inside and remembered that spirit of my childhood. That, you know, boy, if I ever get out of this house and this community, I'm going to do good. And I just returned to that inspiring self that I always wanted to do good. I always wanted to be of service. I always wanted to be successful. And I never intended to start this long, horrible relationship with alcohol and drugs where I came addicted. I became alcoholic. I became a crack addict. And I got to tell you, that little boy in the ghetto of Austin, Texas, never went to mom and said, "Mother, you know what I want to be when I grow up? What, son? I want to be an alcoholic and drug addict." And I have to tell this audience that I drank and smoked and snorted my way into this disease, and I never intended to. The relationship became important. And I say that, what I mean is, I used my way into where the habit overwhelmed me that this relationship was important. So I drank every day, and I smoked pot every day, and I used cocaine as often as I could. And there came a time when I didn't even have a choice at that. And now I'm clean 20 years, and I thought I needed to write this book and share these intimate things that people normally wouldn't share with the entire country, where a mother or a father or a sister or a brother may get this book for themselves and for somebody they love and care about and say, "Hey, you know what, if this guy Thomas Henderson can go to the bottom that he went to and return to a life of functionality, of being a good father to his children and being a grandfather and being a community activist, then you can turn your life around too."
What was your childhood like? You just mentioned about a little bit about
My childhood was adventurous. I was raised in a segregated community. I was born in 53, so somewhere around 57, 58, I was a little guy running around with no shirt on in a part of town that was sort of the heartbeat of the community, where there were taxi stands and barbecue places and pool halls and pinball machines and alleys and winos and just a really tight little segregated community in East Austin, Texas. My mother and my father both drank alcohol, and as early as back as I can remember, I sort of sipped on it, and it was cute, and my parents would fight with each other, and at one point when I was 12 years old, my mother at close range shot my stepfather with a rifle. They were both drunk. He had hit her. And so I saw things in my early childhood. I didn't meet my father till I was 22 years old, and I'd been drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. All of a sudden, he shows up in my life. Hey, my son, you know, 21 years, I was a mistake down in Texas, and when I became a cowboy, he came back. And so I have interesting, traumatic memories of childhood, but overall, my childhood was just what I would call, you know, complicated but doable. In that, being raised in a segregated community, I was never called the N-word. I never saw my parents embarrassed, ashamed. So I did not grow up with a chip on my shoulder about racism. I saw Malcolm X on television or Martin Luther King, but I never got it right there in my eye or in my heart, or no one shamed or degraded me growing up. And that was really one of the complicated things about my relationship with Tom Landry, was that I was an African American who was not contaminated, nor did I know my place. I think if you're older than Thomas Henderson, if you're 55 or 60 years old and you're African American, you saw it, you read where they said, you can't use this restroom, go around the back. I didn't see it, never experienced it. And so when I became a Dallas Cowboy, when Tom Landry and I met, the first thing he said to me is, you need to shave that beard off. And I said to him, I didn't come here to shave. I came here to play football.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, you take that back 10 years prior. If it was 1965 instead of 1975, I believe Thomas Henderson would have said, yes, sir, I'll shave it tonight.
Mm-hmm. And what was Tom's reaction to your response?
He told me I needed to go see a doctor. I told him I couldn't shave because back then we didn't have track two razors, and I had something called pseudo-full follicles. I might not be pronouncing that correctly, but ingrown hairs.
I see.
Would happen, and I would cut myself to death trying to shave, so I quit shaving. And he had a rule that rookies had to shave. But I still, forget the rule, I didn't come here to shave. And it was me questioning him like that he'd never seen, heard, or been a part of in his entire coaching career. Because, yeah, you got to look him up. He played in the 40s and early 50s with the New York Giants, where players had to stay at separate hotels. So Tom Landry, without even, because this man is not a racist, but Tom Landry, I think, had a sense that African Americans knew their place.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a bad way. I'm not trying to make that bad.
I understand what you're saying.
It's just culturally, yes.
But you were one that had not. And
didn't know my place.
No. Yeah, and probably shocked
and
him a little
I think
bit.
I write about that in the chapter about Tom Landry.
Yes, yeah, you do. You touch on that. Absolutely. You know, you mentioned that.
By the way, I want your listeners to know that if they can't find In Control in their local bookstore, that they should go to Amazon.com, In Control, and get this book for somebody you care. Get it for yourself. This is a really good book.
I was going to send it to HollywoodHenderson.com as well.
Yes, sir.
Good
yes,
place
sir.
For it. But, yes. Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned Mom and Dad were drinkers. And they say that addictive behavior is something that's actually in the genes, and maybe you didn't know that, but you may not have had any control over what was going on in your life. Obviously, you took control. But do you believe at all that sometimes that these things are you know, in your genetics?
Yeah, but I also think that you can really help it along with a bad relationship with alcohol and drugs. I think you can multiply whatever that is. For instance, I have this theory about football players. Some have it, some don't. And that is that thing, that DNA that I will knock your teeth out and help you pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of player. So I think genetically there is some predisposition to some of us who, once we start to drink alcohol, we'll become alcoholic. Or once we use some drugs, we'll become drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who will drink alcohol and go, I don't like the way that tastes, and never drink again. Or somebody will do some drugs and go, you know, that's... One guy one time said, I offered a guy some drugs. He took a hit and of crack, and when he got up off the floor, if you will, he said to me, that's too good. I'm never going to do that again. And he never touched it again. So it just depends.
Yeah. Now, do you have children?
Two children. I have a 25-year-old daughter, 11-year-old daughter, and I have two grandchildren, a 6-year-old granddaughter named Taylor, and a grandson, 22 months old, Carl Thomas.
Now, did either of your daughters have a problem at all with
No, my daughter is 25, and she doesn't drink. I think my daughter tells me that, you know, she has a drink once a month, if that. She goes out with her, you know, her husband, and they'll, you know, have a drink. But no, my daughter knows that she's probably predisposed to alcoholism, and she doesn't have a relationship with alcohol.
Mm. Are either of your daughters talented athletes?
Yes, my daughter, 25-year-old, ran track in high school. And my 11-year-old can swim like a fish. has an enviable backstroke at 11 years old. She's really long, and we got her into some swimming programs. This girl, she has Olympian type style.
See, well, a lot of that's something that's genetic too, but that's a good thing.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's good things and bad things you can get through the genes.
That's right.
Yeah, this book is. I thought it was. It's a great book for. I've never had a problem at all with substance abuse. I experimented, and that was pretty much it. I had no interest in, and I still don't drink at this point in my life. I'm 50. But you know, I know people who do. I know people who still do and still have problems, and they have them for years. And this is something.
But don't you think this is a book that'd be a nice little something to come in a ribbon at Christmas, or just, you know, here's a book I think you ought to read.
See, here's an interesting thought, though, because, yeah, it would be, but as you know, people who have these kind of problems don't readily admit it, only when they're ready to conquer them. So if you hand this to somebody that is an addict, or you know, someone who's got a relationship with substances, many times they will say, well, I don't need that. I'm not like that. I'm not like Thomas Anderson. I'm not Hollywood. You know, what I'm saying?
And but you know, they always say, though, that, you know, when the patient is ready, the teacher will appear. I don't think this is something you give to someone and say, here, you need to read this. I think you need to be more subtle about it. It's just like you wouldn't approach somebody who had a drinking and drug problem. You would approach it very carefully. You go, I need to talk to you. Or you never would do it. And that is the irony of our family and friends who have alcohol and drug problems. Everybody's sort of afraid to bring it up. Everybody's afraid to sort of confront it. And just like you said, you would even have reservation given the book to somebody for what? For the fear of their reaction to it.
Well, you know, it's the same.
Which means you ought to give it to them if you have some concern about it. Hey, their reaction to it is irrelevant to you.
Well, if you're friends with someone and you're trying to help them, you're absolutely right. And you know, I have friends who are weekend warriors who, you know, get wasted on weekends. And they think that's cool. But that can be just as destructive as someone who's, you know, and when you were playing football, you weren't, I assume you were not wasted on the field for the most part.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Because you knew better.
Not to be, anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, you knew better, but when you weren't working, you're out there doing your thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
The book is called In Control, Thomas Hollywood Henderson. And again, you can just go to hollywoodhenderson.com or go to your nearest bookstore and get the book. It's also, I thought, very interestingly written on your own publishing company, Thomas Henderson Publishing. Are you publishing other
people? The New York publishers didn't think that this was an important book. And I differed with them, and I published it myself, and all the proceeds are going to go to charity.
Now, are you going to publish other? Are you going to publish other people's work, Tom, as well?
You know, if there's something that I like, I might consider that.
How important? I want to ask you about this because, I mean, I have never really talked to anybody who won a lottery like $28 million. I mean, you're a guy that was making a ton of money, I assume, being in the NFL, and probably put most of it up your nose. In fact, lost everything that you had, and then here you are. You've cleaned up your act. You're sober, you know, 16 years, and all of a sudden you win. Well, now 20, but when you won this, it was about 16 years, right? So I mean, and all of a sudden, you win $28 million. Were you looking at the heavens and saying, "Okay, thank you, I appreciate that"?
You know, I just thought it was a strange gift. I was doing very well financially again in my life, real estate, selling films, doing lectures around the country. You know, one of the fun things I do is go into communities and give lectures at drug rehab clinic centers or alumni reunions of drug addicts. And and 12-step meetings around the country and colleges, and I was doing fine. I mean, I was grinding, but I was doing fine. And I tell you what I think the difference was. I built a football stadium in my hometown, and then in 1997, I fasted for 7 days to raise $300,000. I slept in the middle of a football field and told the community, I'm not eating and I'm not going home until the community brings me $300,000. On the seventh day, I had the $300,000. By 1999, that was 97, that was October 97, early 99, I finished the track for the kids. Scoreboard, pole vault pit, long jump pit, shot put area, high jump area, seven-lane polyurethane track, goalposts, scoreboards, field house, the whole shebang. I did it all myself. I worked 60, 70 hours a week building this thing for the kids in my community because my ticket out of the ghetto was sports, and I always really wanted, if there was something I wanted to give back, it would be, here is a place where you can hone your skill as a runner, a jumper, a football player, whatever kind of athlete you want to be, but here's a good place to start it at. And so I finished that late in 99. And I stood on a hill and said, you know, that's good. You know, I had laid on the ground and fasted for 7 days to raise the money to do that, and I still don't know where that strength or the idea came from. But a few short months later, God blesses me with a $28 million lottery ticket. Now, you can call it whatever you want to call it. I look at it as karma, fate, and a gift from God.
Oh, as
because
was
of the work.
Yeah, as was the strength to do what you did before that to build the field.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, one thing that, of course, happens when you win a lot of money, or if you're a huge success in sports, is that people come around and ask for things. And you have some very interesting stories in there, one of them about one of your coaches at Langston who called you asking for money. I mean, that must be, it's a difficult thing that happens, but you got to deal with it.
You have to learn how to say no, and you have to say it very fast. because the longer the conversation goes on, the more uncomfortable the outcome is going to be. So I've learned through trial and error that the faster I say no, the easier it is to say no.
This guy actually asked you to loan him $500,000, telling you that he wanted to pay his debts off and he'd pay you back whenever he could.
I mean, yeah, he wanted to pay me back monthly.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, that's, you know, no matter how much money you've won or how much money you have, you have to put limits on people, because I'll tell you, if you had said to him, okay, I'll give you a couple hundred thousand dollars, 2 years later he'd call you again, you know, I went through that, I really need some money, you know.
Oh, you know, yeah, money is like, you know, money is like trying to hold on to water. And so I have just, you know, really tried to just keep it simple and not give people money, because I found out something, man. I've given away money that I felt good about, and I've given away money that I felt bad about. And so there's a balance.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Tom, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and it was always fun watching you on the field, and now it's even more fun seeing the great success that you're having off the field. And the book is called In Control, The Rebirth of an NFL Legend, Thomas Hollywood Henderson. And again, it's published by Thomas himself, and it's available at HollywoodHenderson.com and also in bookstores around. You'll find them. If you don't have it, have them order it from Thomas Henderson. If you want to order it online, you can do that as well. Thanks so much for coming on.
You can also order it on Amazon.com.
Exactly.
In Control. Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too.